Well, welcome everyone to this session on grappling with gnarly issues, how local governments can help. This is a part of the ICMA coaching program. We're delighted to have the support of so many ICMA state associations, 30 of them now, Delaware being our latest addition, that are helping to provide these programs to you, identifying topics, presenters, and giving us feedback on how we can be of service to the profession through these and other ICMA coaching program services. We're also pleased to have 10 outreach partners, the latest addition being the Local Government Association of British Columbia. These associations help us reach out and engage a broader audience geographically, demographically, and encourage these resources being available and engaging to all of those different audiences and their interests. So thank you all for the work that you do in helping us reach out. One of the things that we did for this webinar was invite people in the registration process to share with us what are the gnarly issues that they're dealing with. And this is a word cloud of all the things that came through. There you can see hundreds of issues, literally, that people had. Housing, homelessness comes up big, mental health, environmental issues, opioid crises, etc. Those are all topics that are going to be, in fact, examples that our presenters will be offering here today to give you insights into how they've been approaching those kinds of issues. But what I want to highlight from today's session is that whatever your gnarly issues are, and we had people range a whole variety of topics, including one agency that had as its gnarly issue how to deal with the puppy mills that were in its jurisdiction. As we all know, local governments are getting drawn into these and other topics more and more, maybe through the dysfunction at higher levels. Things come to roost at lower levels in local government where people feel that something can be done and they want something to happen. So the result is that this is becoming a very challenging arena for people to work in, to figure out how you address these topics, how you get your arms around them, how to make a difference. And I'm delighted that we have an outstanding group of presenters to address these topics with you today. And they've been working really hard with me in the preparation of this webinar, and I'm grateful to them for that. John Crumpton, the county manager in Lee County, North Carolina, is going to kick it off. He's going to be talking about some very challenging environmental issues that they've encountered. John has a doctorate in education, a master's in business administration, and he teaches at UNC's School of Government in a program for a master's degree program for local government, and he teaches the Introduction to City and County Management. So he's going to be sharing with you what they're dealing with in Lee County, how they've approached it, and what lessons learned they have from that that can apply to other environmental issues, but also other issues that you might encounter that are of a tough nature. We'll be moving on to Marie Peoples. She's a deputy county manager in Coconino County, Arizona. She's a deputy county manager there. She was previously chief health officer. She's won a number of civic awards for her work, and she has a doctorate in public health epidemiology. And you'll see that that really factors into her discussion about how do you get data on these gnarly issues to get a handle on them? And then how do you galvanize partnerships to help deal with crises like the opioid crisis? And there are many transferable lessons from that one. And then we're going to be turning to our third topical area, one around homelessness. And I know that's really on a lot of people's minds. And they're going to be looking at how they've gone about a solution in Santa Cruz, and actually a regional solution now with 12 different agencies in the greater Bay Area of San Francisco that have picked up an approach, and I think you'll find it a unique approach, of how do you solve homelessness by creating a sense of community. So Susie O'Hara is the assistant city manager in Santa Cruz, talking about that. She comes out of a civil engineering background. So as an engineer, she's been thinking about how do you get your arms around this? How do you noodle through this challenging issue? How do you get to the root causes? And how do you do that in a way that engages the community? And with her is going to be Chris Richardson, the chief program officer for Downtown Streets. And he has 12 chapters now, as I mentioned, in around the Bay Area, staff of over 65, has been working very closely with communities and businesses to figure out how to really solve homelessness in an effective way. So lots of lessons that are be transferable from this. And I'm Don Maruska, Master Certified Coach and the producer and director and moderator of the ICMA coaching program. So thank you all for joining us. We're going to take a look at a number of polling questions here. Our first one is really about how many people are participating at your location. We always like to encourage people to learn together. What happens through that is that you're able to get a kind of critical mass of people that can help you going forward. And so I encourage you to respond to each of the polling questions, and we'll get a read on this. As we're doing that, I just want to highlight, again, if you're looking for the presentation materials, they're available 24 hours in advance at icma.org/coachingwebinars, and click on Agendas and Archives on that page, and you'll get to the resources that are there, and click on the agenda packet, and everything's loaded in that agenda packet. Also in the handout that's available through GoToWebinar system directly during the session here today. And it'll be available again 24 hours after the session. So we encourage you to take advantage of all those resources and make the most of them for yourself and for your agency. So we'll give just a moment more to see how our audience is shaping up for today's session. And so pleased that so many of you have joined us. Let's take a look. We're going to share those polling results, and we can see that 81% of you are there on your own. We're very thankful for each and every one of you. We're also seeing groups of varying sizes, some up to 10 in number, so that's great. Glad to have you all participating in today's session. So with that, I'm going to be turning the presentation over to John Crumpton. John, thank you so much for being with us here today. We're eager to hear your story of how you've been navigating some gnarly issues there in Lee County.
Thank you, Don. And I still see the poll up there, so I don't see my presentation just yet. There we go. All right. Thank you. I am John Crumpton, and I do work in Lee County, North Carolina. I'll get a map up here real quick of where Lee County is. Just a second, too quick on the button there. Lee County is located just south west of Raleigh, about 40 minutes, and just north of Pinehurst, about 30 minutes. So geographically, we are in the center part of the state. And Don, the cursor, there we go. I need to go back one, please, sir. I'm having issues with the, there we go.
Yeah, these are the, Don, I think that'll help you.
Yeah, that wasn't working. So anyway, we'll, just go on this one, and then I'll try that again. But the two gnarly issues that I decided to deal with involve environmental issues. One is coal ash storage, and the other is oil and gas exploration, which were both new issues to our county. The key items that I'd like for y'all to take away from this is how to deal with your board dynamics here in Lee County. We have a lot of diversity on our boards, and we have a split. I currently have a split board. I have a lot of 4-3 votes dealing with Democrats and Republicans, and we're kind of a microcosm for politics. As you look at the nation, we're just as have as many issues as I would say federal and state governments do. And then the second issue you should take away is communication, and that's a very broad area because that's just not communication with your boards, but with your staff, with experts in the field that you're dealing with the media, and with your citizens. And then from a professional standpoint, these two issues brought up a lot of ethical issues for me, and because they were highly political, and as you know, In our code of ethics, you try to stay out of politics. So, riding that fine line and trying to be effective in what we were trying to do. was difficult in these two issues. So some issues, again, facing the board dynamics are state legislative involvement. With both of these issues, our legislature was actively involved. Since there was a big impact on our community, our citizens got actively involved. We had environmental groups show up, and we had one in particular that set up camp here in Lee County. I've already discussed the ethical issues. And then we rode the roller coaster on both issues. One minute there was support locally for it, and then the next minute there was no support. So it went up and down, and we had to change our tactics quite often. So in the first issue I'm going to go over is the coal ash. And back in 2014, we had a spill from one of Duke Energy coal ash basins in the northwestern part of the state. It prompted our legislature to act in September to pass the Coal Ash Management Act. And if I can say anything there is you should always be paying attention to what your legislature is passing, because we did not have a coal ash plant in Lee County, so we did not feel like this legislation would even impact us, and boy, were we wrong. So because on November 12th, representatives from Duke and Char came and told us that a former brick plant that had some pits that were from, dug from for the brick would be used as one of their coal ash storages. So in January of 2015, my board changed, went from a Republican board to a Democratic board, and my board decided they didn't like this and we're going to try to get involved. So those of you who don't know what a coal ash depository looks like, it's actually, they like to call it, the companies call it, a structural fill. I got to tour a structural fill at Asheville Airport. And for those of you who are in the solid waste business, know that this looks like a lined landfill. And there's what it looks like again. And this is kind of an overview of the 118 acres that they were going to use for structural fill. And then we did a 3D drawing of what it would look like. So they were filling the pond, and then property actually that did not have a brick basin, but and baked these two flat areas with coal ash. So what did our commissioners want to do? Well, initially, because we were in the middle of a board change, the first 60 days, not much happened. But after that first 60 days, the new Democratic board wanted to fight. And so their number one goal was to stop the coal ash from coming to Lee County. But after we did our research and realized that the legislature could do what they wanted to do, they changed their position because they realized they weren't going to be able to stop it to getting a host fee and trying to deal with the impacts from this coming to our county. So the options I tried to offer the board were, they could hire an attorney and try to use our court system to delay the project. Second option was to contact our legislature, who flipped from a Republican to a Democrat, and a Republican controlled the legislature, so that really wasn't a great option. And we did do the third one, which was contact Duke directly, and they weren't real interested in talking with us. And of course, there's always the option to do nothing. So what did we end up doing? Well, we really wanted to talk to Duke Energy. So we used the media, our local media here, and we were able to get our message out to the national media through some Facebook posts, and some folks seem to be interested. So just using the Los Angeles Times article from February 1st, 2015, I actually was interviewed twice by the Los Angeles Times, and so the Associated Press picked it up. And there's one thing that a major publicly held company does not like, and that is bad publicity, because it hurts their stock price. So with all that bad publicity they were getting, they decided to come and talk with us. I don't have enough time, but in the end, we ended up getting an agreement with Duke, and they were going to pay us a host fee for it. So we ended up getting what we wanted, but had to we had to be play some hardball on it. So actually what has happened is, as of today, 5 years later, when all started, not a single ton of coal ash has been stored in Lee County. And it looks like it probably won't happen. And we're trying to set up a meeting with the folks that own the site. And we're actually trying to get control of the site. The second issue
just before
is
we jump into the next example here, John, could you just talk a little bit about how you personally navigated your role with the shifting political winds of your board and of the state? How did you, what did you find you most particularly needed to do to help your community navigate this gnarly issue, and deal with that in such a complex political environment?
Yeah, the first thing I felt like I needed to do was get support of the chairman. She was bringing four votes to every meeting, so I wanted to make sure that the actions I was taking that she was in support of. And then because of how sensitive an issue, I made sure all seven of the board members were educated on the issue. This was something most of us here in Lee County knew nothing about. We didn't know what coal ash was, and there were probably a lot of folks across the country that don't. So we dealt with a lot of education with the board. We held a lot of meetings, and we also did a lot of education where the public was coming in and meeting with us. So kind of like town hall meeting type things where we were going around the community. We actually went out in the community where the storage facility was going to be and met out there with them. So there are a lot of moving dynamics, but overall, moving back on that communication issue is making sure you had everybody involved and everybody that knew what was going on.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So the next issue was oil and gas exploration. And I know there are probably folks across the country that have oil and gas exploration in their states, but North Carolina has never had oil and gas exploration in our state of any type. So there are no laws on the books. And so when this was first brought to us, the community was intrigued, especially the people who were the big landowners who saw what was going on up in Pennsylvania in the Marcellus Shale area, where they were, people were making big money, we thought. So some folks down here thought they were going to get rich. And initially, they were really supportive of it. I hit the button twice there. Go back to that map. This is a different map of the county. And the pink area on the western side of the county is the area that is believed to contain the shale and contain the gas. So it was in our state, we're kind of ground zero for fracking industry. And in 2010, they showed up and started signing leases with our citizens who knew nothing about what was going on. There was no state law that would allow the industry to drill. And we had an interesting group decided to step up to the plate and do citizen engagement and education. And that was our cooperative extension, which is in North Carolina, part of North Carolina State, North Carolina A&T. So they seemed to be an ideal group to do the education. And it was back in 2010, we were just getting into the Facebook world, and cooperative extension was able to use Facebook posts. And I'm sorry, I wasn't able to find any from back then, but they were real effective in getting the word out about these sessions and conducting these town hall meetings. But once again, in 2012, the board dynamics changed, the Republicans take control, and we end up with getting some outside influences from the Oil and Gas Commission in the state, and the chair of the Oil and Gas Commission is a newly elected board member to my board. So that was a highly ethical issue, whether he was protecting our interests or whether he was protecting the state interests, and that caused the environmental groups to show up. And so we went from a very calm situation to all of a sudden a very hotly contested issue. And the state started the process of passing the laws to allow it. So, and then the environmental groups were able to start getting the public perception to be against it. And so in December of 2014, you probably recognize that date from the coal ash, the board changes from Republican to Democrats, and the Democrats decide that they're going to fight this. So, a lot of things happened at the state level to slow this process down. And we also passed a fracking moratorium, which was a highly ethical issue for us and as staff, because we felt like, passing that moratorium may have gone across that line of what we could and couldn't do. And actually, I advised the board at that meeting not to pass that resolution, and they passed it anyway. So we, made for a very interesting time personally and professionally dealing with something that we felt like shouldn't have happened. But in the end, we still don't have any fracking here in North Carolina. I forgot that last point. No permits have been issued. The state has passed laws and rules. But, with the downcline in the oil and gas industry, nothing has happened here. So the takeaways is, before gnarly issues come up, we as managers should make sure that we have good relationships with all our board members. So no matter what party they're in, no matter whether they're in the majority or the minority, you need to have good relationships with all your board members. And then I really feel like as the manager, it's more my responsibility to give options, not to give them the solutions. So those options are solutions, but if they, if you're the manager and you're saying this is what we need to do, sometimes the board won't buy into it and you won't go anywhere. So you try to get the board, the majority of the board, to choose that option so you know where you're going. And try to determine if the issue is going to be a short or long drawn out process. So when the coal ash issue came up, initially we were in panic mode. We didn't know what was going on. We were running around with our head chopped off, and here we are 5 years later, nothing has still happened. So after we got over that initial, hurdle, we realized being patient was a good thing. And we as managers should use our processes, the bureaucratic process, to slow things down. And then before you act, you might want to understand the local and state politics that are involved. And we have a very strong legislature here in North Carolina, so you don't really want to get too far out ahead of them unless they know what's going on, especially your local delegation. And then in both processes, we learned a lot about keeping citizens engaged, the importance of using Facebook at that time, which was the main platform we were using. But now we use Twitter and we use Instagram and all those different outlets, and having a coordinated effort in getting your message out to your citizens. And then I know that your local media sometimes isn't you don't believe they're your friend, but if you understand who to contact with your local media and how to get a message out to them, you can use them to help. And we use that in the coal ash issue to help us get a message out nationally. And so we have a strong manager network here in North Carolina, and I called a lot of other managers about my issues and making sure I wasn't crossing that line of political dealing with our ICMA ethics and kind of taking on these companies. And then in the end, we actually ended up fighting the legislature on the oil and gas issue. So, you have some ethical issues and you need to be, careful there. So, calling your other managers, and then also, if I felt like I needed to, I could have called ICMA and talked to folks there and talked to Martha and gotten some good advice as well. So, Don, I think that is it for mine.
Okay. Well, we're going to go to the polling question here, and what we'd like to do is see how what John shared with you resonates with you, so that we get a read on how these things are landing in your world. So why don't you check off as many of these items as you think would be helpful to you as you deal with whatever the gnarly issues in your world. A couple of things are coming through and some questions that I'm seeing come through this, especially around the social media. People are wondering, do you have particular training for your staff in social media? Do you have guidelines? How did you decide what you would cover in social media and what you wouldn't and how you would position it? Seems like that's a very challenging arena, and people would love to know some more about how you navigated that.
Well, to answer the first two parts, yes. So, yes, we have a policy in place, and yes, we do training mainly with my department heads because they are the ones in control of what I would call the department pages. But on these two issues, before anything went out, we coordinated that through my office. So it's hard. I know everybody, you have different departments that want to get their message out, and trying to control the message and make sure it's consistent with everything that you're doing. This whole issue we ended up hiring a communications relations person, and we coordinate, especially the gnarly issue topics, we coordinate everything through her. So yes, we have that policy in place, and yes, we practice it and talk about it a lot to make sure that we have an organized message.
Okay, great. And if somebody wanted to access that social media policy, is there a web link, or could they just send you an email to obtain that?
Yeah, if they'll just send me an email, we'll be glad to get that back to them.
Okay, super.
We also have We also have a communications policy that the board adopted, and that really helps us as well, that states who can really speak on behalf of the county on these gnarly issues. Of course, politicians sometimes don't like the official statement of the county, but pretty much says that the county manager and the chairman are the spokespeople. So we try to funnel those major things through the two of us, and so we have a consistent message.
Great. And have you found that you've been able to keep that a policy in place across the political changes back and forth of your board, so that?
Well, I would say 95% of the time it works. With the political dynamics I have, every once in a while you have a commissioner who will go off on a tangent on his own or her own, and not like what the majority is doing, and so you end up, with those kind of issues. But that's the chairman's responsibility to take care of that. And that's one of those lines you don't want to cross as the manager, saying that someone on your board has not followed the policy. You let the elected officials, monitor themselves.
Okay. And just to come back to one of the challenging ethical issues that you encountered about, being in defiance of what the state law was, how did you navigate that? Because in the very political environment that you're in, it's easy for the elected officials and the public to sort of view you as standing in their way, if you will. How did you provide your professional advice in a way that, didn't get, painted with that broad brush?
Right. Well, I made sure that once again, working through the chairman, that the chairman was communicating with our local delegation at the state level. And also, we were communicating with the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners quite a bit and telling them what we were doing. And a couple of times we got some advice from the association that we probably should back down. So since they really do the lobbying for us up at the North Carolina legislature, if I felt like maybe we were crossing the line any, I would get some advice from them, and they would help us. And a lot of times they would go talk to maybe the chairman of a committee that was involved with that issue, or even talk to the speaker or the Senate pro tem about our issues. So once again, you have to have those relationships and good communication to help you deal in that arena that you all of a sudden find yourself in. And so I tried not to personally get in the media and say anything against our legislature and any of our representatives, but you have to kind of channel that through your politicians.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, John. Lots of lessons there on how to address some gnarly issues and deal with that over time across changing elected official dynamics. We're going to turn now to our next presentation, which is about the opioid crisis. And again, as a lens to look into how to get one's arms around these gnarly issues. And what was a technique in particular used by a small rural county? We have lots of smaller agencies, rural agencies, county and city and towns that are looking for guidance on how to deal with issues that are oftentimes much larger than their capacity. So, Marie Peoples, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your story.
Thanks, Don. Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon in certain locations. And hello from Coconino County, home of the Grand Canyon. What I really wanted to talk about today, as Don shared, was that smaller rural jurisdictions can be competitive when it comes to opioids in terms of looking for funding and bringing the issues to the community. And so I'll share more about that. And then I also wanted to share about learning to be nimble. We learned many lessons along the way in our quest to really dig into the opioid issues within our community. And then my third takeaway would really be, don't be afraid to try many unconventional approaches. So just a little bit about opioids, and I won't belabor it. Everybody by now is familiar with the opioid epidemic, but what this slide really highlights is the toll that it's taken on our communities across the nation, and that opioid overdose deaths have quadrupled since 1999, and that nearly half of opioid overdoses involve a prescription drug. So there's many statistics about opioids. And then we know that opioids impact people of all races, all ethnicities, all walks of life, income levels. Opioids, along with other drugs, don't discriminate. And this really is a nationwide issue that impacts all of us. Don, I'm struggling with advancing. Thank you.
Here we go.
I appreciate it. So here's just another quick slide, again, that I won't belabor, but it tells more of the story of how opioids have impacted the nation. And certainly you guys are familiar with this in your own communities as well. And it's hard to watch the news without hearing a story about opioids and the toll that it's taken. So on to the next slide. Shockingly, again, just another sad fact, but shockingly, opioid overdoses now kill more people in the United States than car accidents or gun violence combined, which really also points to the need for jurisdictions, if you haven't already begun the work, to start digging in. So this slide, I think, speaks volumes. 8 out of 10 people who use heroin were first using prescription opioids. And what this tells us, an addiction is addiction, and there shouldn't be stigma associated with addiction, but we know that there is. And so what this really tells us regarding the stigma and how this epidemic has had a little bit of a different face, because the 8 out of 10 people who have used illicit substances have gotten a prescription first. And so this is often populations that we don't associate with substance abuse. And so it might be our teen athletes, people that have common medical issues and maybe have a routine procedure, dental procedures. So again, knowing this background, it really helps address community issues and perhaps how the population might look a little different than some of the traditional populations that governments and entities have dealt with in terms of substance abuse. Just a little bit about Coconino County. So we are rural and we have small populations, but one of our factors, and every jurisdiction has unique challenging factors, but one of our most challenging factors is that we are huge geographically. We're the second largest county in the contiguous United States. Our land mass is larger than Vermont and New Hampshire combined. But with that, we only have a population of a little of 140,000. So we're spread out. And that was one of the reasons why we were really trying to be creative in how we address our specific opioid issue. And in terms of seeking funding and realizing that we just weren't competitive, even when there was a lot of opioid dollars being released, we weren't competitive with larger jurisdictions. And again, every jurisdiction has their own SAD numbers. But what we noted was that in Arizona, over 3,500 Arizonans have died since 2017. And I believe those numbers are now higher as we go back and look retrospectively and dig into it. But what that equates to is about 4 Arizonans dying daily due to opioid complications. So again, digging into the data and just talking about when we were looking at grants and trying to bring funding into our jurisdiction to really be able to address this, we knew anecdotally and what we were hearing from community members and what we were seeing ourselves that opioids were in our community. Our little sleepy mountain town was not exempt from this nationwide problem. And so when we looked at our data between 2017 and 2018, we saw that opioid overdose deaths had increased by 140%. And while that sounds really large, when we dug into the numerical data, what it equated to was 14 additional deaths from 2017 to 2018. While any death is way too many, and 14 deaths certainly was large for our small numbers, again, it wasn't large when we're competing with some of the more metropolitan areas. So to really address that, we wanted to get creative in how we looked at the data. And so we looked at some really non-traditional approaches to data. And some of these have become more common since we started doing this a few years ago. But for us, it was really pretty unique to start looking at hospital data. And we thought, okay, we know it's in our community. We're not necessarily seeing it within our medical examiner's office, which was great. It was a great opportunity for us to be proactive by acknowledging we had a problem. So when we started looking at our hospital discharge data, and looking at specific ICD-9 codes and ICD-10 codes, and I'm happy to share that offline if anybody would like more information on that. What we quickly saw, if you advance to the next slide, please, what we quickly saw was that our hospital data really told the picture, and everybody will have a slide, so I won't belabor it, but what we saw was that 1 in 4 of our hospital visits were primarily caused by drugs related to opioids. 1 in 4 visits. That was huge for us. And so then when we also started looking at that and breaking it down by year and looking at, you know, 5-year temporal snapshots, we saw that that increased. Originally, it was the 1 in 4 visits, and then we saw it became, 1 in 3 visits. And then when we narrowed it down to emergency room visits, it was even more. And so then when we looked at the dollars associated with those hospital visits, we could see that $15.5 million in 2016 alone were attributed to opioid-related visits, of which 35% of those were billed to our Medicaid system, which is Access in Arizona. So again, that really helped us tell the story in terms of being competitive for federal funding, statewide funding, and really being able to show that data and in a numerical fashion and fiscal sense, along with the human impact to our decision makers, board of supervisors, county managers, our city counterparts, as well as others, and our private partners as well. So this is really what helped us launch our story. So in doing that, we were able to secure funding. And again, I'm happy to share more offline if anybody's interested. And so we were able to secure funding and put in place several initiatives. And most people are familiar with these initiatives. They're not unique to our jurisdiction. These are things that are tried and proven across the nation. Prescription drug overdose prevention programs, crisis response programs, naloxone distribution programs, prescription drop boxes, substance use prevention coalitions to get the community involved, Good Samaritan laws, community education. What I really wanted to focus on was opioid fatality reviews. We have found that that is a non-traditional approach, and it's something, it's unconventional. And so what we did with our opioid fatality reviews, for those of you that are familiar with root cause analysis, what this really was is we brought together practitioners across communities when we had an opioid fatality. We crafted confidentiality agreements because we needed to have really in the weeds discussions. And with any root cause analysis, the goal is to look at the systematic impacts. And so the people sitting around the table was law enforcement, faith-based entities, many social service entities, and to really look at these safety net intercepts and quite frankly where we dropped the ball, to see where those gaps were or perhaps weaknesses within systems to be able to address these issues. Because what we found is that before somebody passed away of an overdose, they had multiple intercepts with these systems. And so again, the point was not to point fingers and to say blame or to say, you know, agency X, you really failed here. It was to see how we could improve communication, perhaps data systems and sharing, timely responses. And again, with a county of our geographic size, being able to share information across, you know, several hundred miles, transportation and being able to get people where they needed to go, it's really uncovered many issues. But I will share, it's tough to have these in-depth fatality review team meetings because as we all are, we're protective of our organizations, we're protective of our staff, and we all strive to do the best. But there are policies that can be improved across the board. And so I would encourage any of you that are struggling with this issue to consider instituting an opioid fatality review team and to see what that might look like in your community.
Okay, we're going to go to a polling question here because one of the things you've been hearing from Marie about the challenges of the opioid epidemic and what's happening in that regard and how some of these gnarly issues are getting gnarlier. We're interested in learning about what your experience is with the issues that you're confronting in your community and what's occurring. So click off as many of these items as apply to you. We're interested in seeing, you know, what's happening with the array of issues that you're dealing with. And maybe some of you are actually finding things are getting easier to deal with. We'll see. If they are getting easier to deal with, please send us a note in the question function to let us know what it is that you found that's making them easier. Are the issues going away, or you've just found a better way to deal with it? We'd be glad to share some of the ideas that those of you that are finding some success in grappling with these issues might share with our audience. We'd like to have this be a learning community, not just a presentation session out to all of you. And we'll give a moment or two more to see what some of the reactions are for you here. And then we'll go to some additional questions that are coming forward. And we'll take a look. So let's see how the responses go. So a lot of you seeing the issues are getting tougher to solve. You're getting more of them. You're getting drawn into issues that are beyond your scope. We're going to be talking across the panel a little bit later after they share their examples. What's happening in that regard, how to deal with situations where you're drawn into issues beyond your scope. So we'll be getting back to that one. And I see that some people are actually getting better traction or at least less difficulty with gnarly issues. So do let us know what those are. And some of you are also highlighting on this list the challenges of county and state encroachment and local control. And how to deal with those issues. So we're going to be cycling back to some of those in a little bit, but glad to get your reactions here, and we'll be carrying forward with some of the key takeaways and things that Marie wants to share with you about what they've learned.
Yeah, thanks, Don. So when I mentioned when I started the presentation, one of the takeaways was learning to pivot and to be nimble. And so where we really learned to pivot was when we were sharing information with the community and through a variety of ways, your traditional meetings that you have with your regular partners, and then we did some focus groups. But what we really learned is the community said, yeah, we know opioids are within our community. We know that we're struggling, but the true underlying issue is mental health and the lack of mental health resources. Now, while we knew we had a lack of mental health resources, we weren't expecting that pivot. We had done all of our planning, we had done our grant work, we had put these strategies in place for how we thought we were going to address it. And then when we really got the community feedback, we heard something completely different, that the community wanted to focus on mental health. And so that was a huge pivot for us. And as fabulous as our jurisdiction is, like most jurisdictions, it takes a while to change the course. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't take a while and that we were being responsive. This issue is incredibly important to us. And so really our opioid talks became mental health discussions, and we became, we started a really a grassroots coalition that is now called Stronger as One. And that Stronger as One has youth components, media components. When I say media, local dissemination, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, which is really led by our youth coalition that's gotten involved with that. But it involves all the same community partners, but the topic really changed into how do we address mental health? How do we reduce the stigma around it? How can we increase our resources for people to be able to access when they're in crisis? And that's so important in our jurisdiction because, again, we are so rural, we are so isolated, and transportation is a huge issue for us in terms of getting people connected to services. So, again, that was a really large pivot for us, and it was important to listen and then to go back to community funders and to grant funders and to say, okay, we're going to do the initiatives that we talked about, but we also need to do some other things. So again, just to recap, those lessons learned for us is that public health surveillance is critical to be able to inform policy strategies across the board. Public health is a part of our fabric every day in society and within county governments, city governments, any local jurisdiction. And that surveillance can serve as an early warning system for impending public health emergencies. Had we began looking at our hospital data a little earlier, we might have been further ahead. And then a multifaceted public health response is most effective. We know that as a jurisdiction, as many of you indicated on the polling responses, we're being faced with issues that really transcend traditional local government. And so we knew we had to have partnerships, whether that was our traditional community partners, perhaps it was engaging some of our for-profit, nonprofits, but we needed help, and we still need help. And that we also had to be open to innovations that may make our traditional partners uncomfortable. And by that, I am referring to the fatality review. It's very difficult to essentially do an autopsy on someone's life that has passed away and to walk backwards through their steps to see where they've interfaced with all of our systems. And so that has been very meaningful work for us to do. And I think it's really helping us improve how we approach things, how we view people's lives that are impacted by substance abuse, and perhaps what their daily journey looks like when they come through the door to receive services. With that, Don, I will close, and thank you guys for the opportunity to discuss some of these common gnarly issues.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Marie. We're going to go to a polling question here to get some feedback on what resonated for you from what you heard from Marie. And then we've got a bunch of questions that are streaming in. While that poll is open here, let me try to cover a couple of them with you here, Marie. And that is, could you kind of go back over what it is that you felt gave you a competitive standing as a small, rural county in terms of population to get the grants? I know you mentioned many different facets to what you did, but I'm wondering on the competitive grant side, what did the funders especially resonate with that helped you as a rural location get resources?
You know, in terms of the hospital data, really being able to show that time lapse of, okay, 5 years ago, 1 in 5 people were coming in for opioids, and now we've got, 1 in 2 people coming in that have that as an ancillary issue. So being able to show that time lapse of how people were presenting, being able to demonstrate the specific opioid-related drug, being able to do that. And then, of course, breaking it down by age, race, all of those community demographics. And for us, we have a large Latino population, and we have a very large Native American population. And so those items, along with having the data, helped us be competitive. And while jurisdictions may not have those specific racial populations, every jurisdiction has unique populations or factors that they can tie back to the data to be competitive.
So it sounds like really getting a handle on the data and being able to present that data in a compelling way was really effective in your being able to be competitive for resources.
Absolutely. It's all about the story and how the story weaves into the community.
Okay. Well, let's take a look. We can see from the polling responses that your suggestions resonated with many of them, especially using the data, the partnerships, being open to innovations, and engaging the community. I'm wondering if you could take a moment to cycle back here on this item of being open to innovations, even uncomfortable ones. Could you flesh out a little bit, what was an uncomfortable innovation? How did you present it so that people got comfortable with it and supported it, and how did that make a difference?
You know, so I'll, again, talk about the Fatality Review Committee. Again, we signed confidentiality agreements. Those are always important across jurisdictions and certainly important, you know, to my jurisdiction as well. So it's uncomfortable, and just to dive in a little bit without being long-winded. But when we are specifically looking at the overdose death and you're taking the specific life of someone that has overdosed and you're walking back through all of the entities that they've interfaced with, those are uncomfortable for individuals. And we also interview family members to hear what their experiences were with those agencies. And so you may hear uncomfortable things about your specific organization. And we have to get really comfortable as partners to, again, we're not blaming and we're also not taking everything as fact. Because somebody had a bad, reported perhaps a bad interaction with an organization, that doesn't mean the organization is bad. What we're really looking for is life perspective of how people perceive interacting with our agencies and how we can perhaps shape our policy, our training, whatever it takes. And so we really have to become comfortable with saying, you know, we're all going to stand in this space and help each other as we walk through this process, if that makes sense. And it probably sounds really hand-holdish, and I don't necessarily mean for it to be that way either. We really talk about policy-level items and how we can make a difference within our community.
Okay. And people are interested in what were the kinds of grants, and from whom did you receive them, and did you find that the sources were constraining what you could use them for and kind of pushing you away from what you really wanted to do, or did you find ways to get supportive grants for what you really wanted to do? How did you work through that whole aspect of getting resources to help you?
You know, the answer is yes. Some of the funders were restrictive. And, you know, when we went back and tried to get some leeway with restrictive funders, and mostly on the federal side, you know, that was fine. We still needed to do those initial strategies, the more common ones that I talked about, naloxone, the community forums, getting educational awareness to specific groups, whether it was creating faith-based things or, you know, parents, pamphlets, brochures, all those traditional things. We still needed to do that. But we really leveraged our opportunities with funders that were able to be more flexible. And those typically were on the state level or with some of our state you know, nonprofit foundations and charities, those sorts of entities. We found that they were a lot more flexible in terms of the funding because they recognized that there was a lot that we just did not know about opioid use, how it impacts families. And we also recognized that across the nation, people are talking about mental health. And so it was a real natural segue to be able to say, to pivot again, and not to overuse that word, but that's really what we were doing in terms of addressing the issues. And funders appreciated that.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Well, lots of key insights here. And thank you so much for sharing them with our audience. We're going to be
turning now.
And I'm going to be pivoting as well over to the presentation that we have with our colleagues from Downtown Streets. Whoops, let me get this off to the right thing here. Sorry. Just a second, I'm going to a different presentation to help our audience. So this is it. There we go. Okay. And we've got Chris coming back as well. Chris, you want to come on your webcam? Super. And is it going to be Susie or Chris driving the presentation here, and I'll get you lined up?
It'll be me.
Okay. All right. So there you go. And so we're delighted to have Susie O'Hara, Assistant City Manager from the City of Santa Cruz, and Chris Richardson from Downtown Streets team sharing what they're doing to address the issue of homelessness.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Happy to be here. So again, my name is Susie O'Hara. Appreciate the promotion, Don, but I'm an assistant to the city manager. I just wanted to make that clarification for in case my city assistant is watching. So I'm pleased to be here from the coastal community of the city of Santa Cruz. We are a small college town in the central coast of California, experiencing issues that all cities across the west coast of the United States are experiencing, and quite frankly, I'm sure across the entire nation. I'll talk a little bit about our most recent PIT count within the context of the numbers we're experiencing, but also really what that PIT count means in terms of community perceptions and attitudes around homelessness. One key takeaway that I hope to provide for the viewers today is it's really around shifting attitudes as it relates to those experiencing homelessness and their involvement in our community and really providing a community option and around acceptance with regard to that. But also, attitudes really shift the way that we can move forward with implementing programs with regard to homelessness response. So really the topics that I'm going to be covering are around those attitudes. So in Santa Cruz, we have about 2,200, and this is Santa Cruz County, folks that are experiencing homelessness. The majority of those folks are in the city of Santa Cruz, and we do have one of the highest in the state per capita of homelessness in our community, with 80% of our homeless unsheltered. What that really means is our visible unsheltered population greatly impacts perceptions and attitudes around homelessness and its impacts in our community. We saw a slight decrease since the last PIT count, but our community is not experiencing that decrease. And so as we move forward with coming up with creative solutions around addressing the impacts of homelessness and reducing that population, it really does get to shifting attitudes. So I'm going to turn it over to Chris to talk a little bit about the Downtown Streets team's perspectives.
Just before you do, I think people would like to know, what is a PIT count?
It's the point in time count. It's a federally mandated count for the purpose of receiving HUD funding. And so once every 2 years, we deploy, and this is led by the county, volunteers to count as many folks that are outside on the street and in shelters as we can. That PIT count does allow for us to receive our federally mandated HUD funding through our continuum of care.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Susie and Don. For those outside of California and the West Coast, maybe you're not familiar, but we've absolutely seen a surge of homelessness, far beyond crisis here on the West Coast on what we call the I-5 corridor from Seattle all the way down to San Diego in every community. Santa Cruz is not alone. We know we have at least 150,000 folks experiencing homelessness at any given time. That's probably a pretty conservative count, and by conservative, I mean it's probably an undercount using the point-in-time count that Susie had just mentioned. A big chunk of the homeless population nationwide is here, and as Susie alluded to, in California especially, we don't have these folks sheltered. So you're seeing a lot of tents, you're seeing a lot of people sleeping in doorways. Roughly 80% of folks that are experiencing homelessness on any given night are doing so outside, versus communities like New York City, which is sheltering about 99% of their homeless population. One thing when we talk about homelessness, and historically when we've done so, we've usually talked about the folks experiencing homelessness. And I think, for folks interested in this topic, you know that the impacts go far beyond those just experiencing homelessness. I think, City Hall, the county, kind of our local government, partners in our case are really feeling the brunt of this. Another one touches me specifically is the environment. We worked in an encampment called The Jungle that was in San Jose, California, right next to all these tech companies, right in the heart of Silicon Valley. you had 400 to 500 folks living right alongside a creek. We would, cleaning up there, we would pull out everything from refrigerators to car batteries. We would see people bathing just downstream of where people were using the bathroom, and filtering this hazardous waste into the creeks that would ultimately go into the San Francisco Bay and the ocean. In Santa Clara County, more commonly referred to as the Silicon Valley, we did the first ever cost study of its kind to figure out just how much money we're spending on chronic homelessness. We were able to pinpoint and lock down that the county alone was spending over $500 million in the criminal justice system, in the health and hospital system, and the services that they were directly providing, over $500 million a year, which is pretty alarming. So we know solving this issue isn't just about the humanitarian crisis that is homelessness. It makes financial sense. I'm going to turn it back over to Susie here.
So I did want to kick off my part of the presentation by reflecting on a few things that I heard from our previous presenters and give you some context on the city of Santa Cruz. While John has a 4-3 vote with Republican and Democratic supervisors on his board, we have a 4-3 vote right now with uber progressive and then progressive folks on our council. As I'm sure folks along the West Coast and maybe even in the nation know, Santa Cruz is known for its very progressive politics. And even under those circumstances, with decades of incredibly compassionate and progressive values around social justice, we are struggling with managing this crisis from the perspective of NIMBYism and siting. So I just want to say, first things first, local jurisdictions are not alone in this issue. In my research, really focusing on homelessness response, querying up and down California, all the way up to Seattle, from Seattle to San Diego, pretty much every jurisdiction I engage with are dealing with the same issues. Whether your pit count is up or down, there are the impacts of our unsheltered population on the quality of life in our communities, whether it be on our business districts or in our public spaces, is really feeling felt at a crisis level right now. So just wanted to convey that nobody is alone in this challenge, and we're all trying to solve this together. But one thing that I do want to mention that my slides will cover is that for us to really solve this issue or even manage it better at a local level, we do need to do a number of things. One is build partnerships, and then that's across government agencies, nonprofits, and neighborhoods. And speaking of the Downtown Streets team, I'm going to provide some information about how they really have been fundamental in helping the city resolve this. Take risks and experiment with new programs, overbuild to create community acceptance, and then scale back. And that really is around creating programs that there is acceptability in the community and in neighborhoods in particular, and I'll talk more about that. And then involve the community and create space for dialogue. Go ahead, Chris. So with regard to building partnerships and holding each other accountable, as those who are listening in, I'm sure are aware, between cities and county, and particularly cities that serve as the county seat, there really is a lot of finger pointing in terms of who is ultimately responsible for providing solutions around some of these societal issues. I will say that the finger pointing and trying to define roles and having that type of dialogue is thoroughly unhelpful. And we have been through several years of that and have really come to grips with that we have to do this in partnership with the county government and create business plans and plans around how to deal with this issue together. You really must lean highly on your nonprofit sector. Those that have direct service experience with those experiencing homelessness know about what outcomes are achievable and really provide a level of pragmatism as we think about outcomes that we should be measuring. Without your neighborhood groups and your business sector really involved in decision making around program models and siting, you simply are not going to be able to move forward with these types of programs. And so I'm going to talk a little bit more about that as well. One example I wanted to provide that the city took part in and really led over the last couple years is the concept of kind of taking risks and experimenting with new programs and building programs that create community acceptance. One example of that is the River Street Camp. So in 2018, the city of Santa Cruz was experiencing a Hep A outbreak, and there was a lot of transmission of the virus in our downtown corridor for lack of hygiene facilities, and because we had a number of unsanctioned encampments, including one large unsanctioned encampment in our local park. Because of that, and just with a growing crisis around our unsheltered population downtown, we decided to move forward with managing ourselves, with me at the helm, a sanctioned encampment on a parcel owned by our water department. That program ended up being highly successful for a number of reasons, but what was really the most important aspect of it is that we measured success from both client outcomes and neighborhood compatibility. It does get to what Chris was talking about with regard to those impacted by homelessness, and who is affected by homelessness is not just those experiencing homelessness, it is all of the sectors in the community that see and feel those impacts. You need to measure success based on how they feel about these programs as well. So to give you some more information about the River Street Camp, it opened in February of 2018. It was a city, county, and nonprofit partnership. We brought in our nonprofit partners to help build the program model, and then we actually went, our assistant city manager, Tina Scholl at the time, went door to door with the neighbors at the site that we were going to propose, really engaging with those neighbors, and those were businesses and residents, on what the program model recommendations were and how that would fit into their neighborhood, and really receiving their feedback on certain elements of the program. The majority of the occupants of the River Street Camp transitioned from the San Lorenzo Park Benchlands, which was this unsanctioned encampment. And at any time, we had about 54 occupants, and it really did follow the demographics of our unsheltered population in the city. Go ahead, Chris. One thing that I wanted to point out that made this program really different than other programs was the inherent focus on community building. So one of the partners that we brought in for the construction and management of the River Street Camp was the Downtown Streets team. They provided two things for the city of Santa Cruz. We recruited Downtown Streets team members, and Chris will talk more about that program, who were currently unsheltered to live at the camp and work at the camp as camp hosts. By virtue of having folks that are currently unsheltered and with lived experience as part of that community building, it created a tremendous amount of interest in the outcomes around the program, and it created a more safe and secure environment for those that are inside the camp and as well as the neighborhood. In addition to that, the Downtown Streets team, we hired them to beautify and kind of maintain not only the camp, but the surrounding neighborhood while the camp was there. So we had folks on the team out every day of the week, cleaning up the neighborhood, being part of those conversations and dialogue with the neighbors. It made a tremendous difference. Go ahead. In addition to that, and this does, Marie talked a lot about this as well, involve the community and create space for dialogue. Our city council has spent the last 6 months engaging with the community rather ineffectively on new homelessness policy, and it's created just a huge divide in our community about what the right actions are. So in light of that, and with a lot of community opposition, they elected to move forward with developing a community advisory committee on homelessness. These are 13 members of the community representing diverse stakeholder groups, four with lived experience, including two folks that are currently either living in shelters or their cars. And really, the intention of that is to slow down the process and really engage with the community on solutions and provide a forum that's outside of a city council meeting with your 2 minutes of public comment time, which can be quite discouraging for the public to get greater consensus on next steps with regarding to homelessness programming. That committee has convened. We've had a few meetings thus far. And as issues arise at the city council level, they're able to really push those issues over to the CACH for their consideration and for their engagement with the community. And so by virtue of having that, we're really creating opportunities to get the community more involved.
Chris, you're on mute. We can't hear you.
Sorry about that. I was just saying I wanted to thank Susie for not only doing this with us today, but she's an incredible partner, and we kind of joke around. We're in actually 15 communities now. And we kind of joke that we want 14 more Susies, and we're going to clone her. So thank you, Susie, for all that you do in partnership. I want to start off talking about Downtown Streets team, kind of a little bit of our history and our model, because we really were formed to address gnarly issues, and I thought that was pretty apt for our discussion today. Back in 2005, when we were first kind of getting our feet under us, we did a survey in downtown Palo Alto, California, where we launched, and we asked the question, what is the worst part about being homeless, to the folks that were living outside at the time? And you know, the responses really shocked us. For those of us who have never had that experience, we expected it to be not having a place to go to the bathroom, not feeling safe at night. And this is a PDF, so kind of, I guess the response is already spoiled a little bit, but overwhelmingly people said that they felt looked down upon, that they felt marginalized, that they felt isolated, that they felt like they had no community. We heard that they have no friends. And really, this really impacted the way that we went about doing things. And kind of one of my themes today would be build a community around solving this issue. And it's got to also empower the folks that are experiencing homelessness. One of the adages that we have at Downtown Streets team is that homelessness is an experience, not an identity. The conversation has been kind of, I think, collectively always been around that homeless guy, for example. And that person isn't homeless. They're unhoused. They happen to be experiencing homelessness. And if we think about an us versus them, we're not going to move the needle very far. So Downtown Streets team started, like I mentioned, in 2005, the Business Improvement District. The Business Improvement District had just been formed in downtown Palo Alto, and they had identified kind of cleanliness, urban blight, and homelessness, i.e., people sleeping in their doorways, people panhandling, poop and pee all around the downtown as their two biggest issues, two gnarly issues that I think a lot of communities, especially urban communities, face on a daily basis. And so the business community actually formed the Downtown Streets team as a way to try and address both these issues. We say that Downtown Streets team, or DST, is building teams that restore dignity, hope, and purpose, and provide a path to recover from homelessness. What that looks like really is teams of unhoused individuals or folks at risk of homelessness volunteering to clean up in their community. And in return, they get a basic needs stipend. This can be used for storage, for food, groceries. It can be used for cell phone, transportation, really as a way to get someone from survival mode and into goal setting mode, and as a stepping stone into employment and long-term income. They also receive case management, employment services, and probably more so than anything, a positive supportive network of their peers. So you can see right here, we have someone getting their Downtown Streets team shirt, their yellow shirt, welcoming them to the team as one of our blue shirts or one of our managers or team managers. The team is really focused in every single community around this team meeting. It happens every single week in every single community. And when we were coming into San Francisco, SF Magazine called it part church revival, part 12-step meeting, with a little hiring hall and job fair thrown in. It's one of the things I'm particularly proud about, this quote is the undefeated people. when folks join our team, they really show off a ton of resiliency. And they're doing the almost impossible, which is rising with everything against them to get out of homelessness. And what I've realized the secret sauce with Downtown Streets team is it's really their peer network. It's the other people that are encouraging them. It's the other folks encouraging them. It's the support network. When they join the team and they get their shirt, the other team members say to them, here's your shirt. You're part of our team now. We're going to represent the homeless community in a positive light. We're going to be the heroes in this community. And that means that we're going to hold you accountable when you're wearing that shirt, but we're also going to support you. And so I think that really is the secret sauce, is the team members themselves. Here in Silicon Valley, if you ask any CEO, what their greatest asset is, I'm sure they'd tell you their people. And so we're trying to apply that to homelessness as well. The people that are experiencing homelessness have for so long been kind of discounted, and they're really an asset in the community struggle that is homelessness. So years ago, after we started in Palo Alto, we open sourced the model, said, here, take our operations manual, take our name, do what you will with it. And two communities in California, and believe it or not, two communities in Florida ran with the model, but were not successful. And so in about 2011, we asked them to stop operating using our name and have since then been growing. We launched in Santa Cruz in 2017 and have worked on various projects with Susie. I owe her a lot of beer or flowers or something, but she doesn't seem to want to take me up on them. It's been an incredible partnership, and I think that's a key takeaway as well, is you need these very strong partnerships in order to be successful. Lucky enough, one thing that's made my job much easier is last year, the League of California Cities and the California State Association of Counties got together to create a homelessness task force. They produced a report after looking at homeless service interventions throughout the state, and they identified five evidence-based best practices in the state of California. Downtown Streets team was one of them. You better believe that I carry this report around with me in my backpack everywhere I go, just in case I need it. It was also published in partnership with the Institute for Local Government. And one of the things that we're proud of as well here is that we're the only one of those five evidence-based best practices to actually expand out of a single community. One of the other things as well is they called us a community service, not a homeless service. And I think that really resonated with us. And it was powerful to hear someone else describe us that way, because we really do see ourselves as an entire community service. We're obviously providing, beautification services, but we're getting everybody on board, whether it's folks that are experiencing homelessness or folks that, maybe have negative connotations towards homelessness. One of the things I'm so proud of the work that we do, and with Susie, like at the River Street Camp, is changing those perceptions. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And this all sounds good, but if we're not actually moving people out of homelessness, it's all for naught, really. We're pretty excited. This slide's a little old, but we're about to celebrate 1,000 people moved permanently into housing and 1,000 people that have permanently graduated into employment from the Downtown Streets team. A couple other of the benefits of the work that we get to do is there's certainly health benefits. 84%, you can see here, of our team members now have healthcare, for example. So many of them have now started engaging in services for mental health and substance abuse treatment, or even just taking better care of themselves. This slide is a little old as well. It says 96% of team members stated an overall increase in their self-worth. That also measured their sense of dignity, their sense of motivation, their sense of hope for a better life for themselves. Proud to report, last time we did this anonymous and optional survey, that bumped up to 98%. And then back to kind of my main theme, if you will, it says 99% are proud to be a team member and to give back to their community. So now we have 99% of folks feel less marginalized, less isolated. They feel like a hero in their community. They're proud to be a positive member of their community. We kind of joke that we're going to have a dignometer someday and a white paper, and we're going to prove that if people feel better about themselves, they're going to be much more successful in housing and employment. I think we all can connect those dots. In terms of the community benefits beyond the cleaner, safer streets, for example, right around the River Street encampment, those are obvious. Another benefit to the community, we all know that we need more housing, and we're not going to end homelessness until we build more housing at all levels, including extremely low-income housing, affordable housing on up. But those are not cost-effective, and they're not going to happen tomorrow. Downtown Streets team is a cost-effective solution. The second folks put on our shirts in every community that we're in, we have business owners, we have just folks walking down the street that say, that thank our guys. And it's incredible to see this happen because not only does the community start to have that perception change, our team members, you can see the impact it has on them right off the bat. So moving on to lessons learned, I'll turn it back over to Susie for our last slide.
Yeah, so thanks, Chris, so much. And it has been an amazing partnership. And I think it really does serve as a lesson for local jurisdictions on bringing nonprofit partners in to help build solutions. So with regard to that, you know, I think the lessons we have learned around homelessness response or build these coalitions, especially across city departments. We fund the Downtown Streets team predominantly through our enterprise funds, our refuse fund, our parking fund, our water fund. These are sustainable sources of funding, and the reason why we can do that is because they are working in our watersheds and they are working on our streets to ensure that the trash is being collected and the refuse is not going into our bay. In addition to that, you know, I think this motto of go slow to go fast is really important. Be really deliberate in how you plan for these types of programs and bring those partners in, whether it be across the sectors of the local governments, neighborhoods, business districts, et cetera. Bring people together, because if you don't do that at the beginning, you won't be able to move forward with these programs at the pace that you would like to go. Demonstrate success with small pilot projects and then go to scale. You know, plans are great and words are great and even evidence-based practices and data is great. But unless your community sees success and can touch and feel and hear about it and really experience it themselves, they're not going to believe you. So these small pilot projects make a big difference. The River Street Camp ended up closing after 9 months. And reopening, we never intended for it to go back to the same place. But when we realized we had to and it's open again, those neighbors that were terrified before we moved in the first time welcomed us back the second time. And we're very confident in what we were suggesting we were doing based on their own experiences. In addition to that, the cross-sector collaboration is essential. And I'll turn it over to Chris to talk about kind of the lessons learned with regard to the streets team.
Sure. You know, one of the things that we, when we founded Downtown Streets team, did not set out to do, I wish I could say we were smart enough. We had a whiteboard and everything was there and we were just so brilliant. But by necessity, we actually weren't able to go out with our team members to, in the early days, to, it was just one of us at the time. We weren't actually able to go out with our team members during their work experience shift. And so we built that ladder of success where you saw that blue shirt and that manager and someone in a green shirt who's a team leader, and they actually run our programs. And it's this empowerment model that we didn't intend to launch, but we've kept very strong since then. And now in 15 communities, in over 90 different projects, every given week, we have team members out there running the show, and they are so empowered. And they are so much more, I'd say, invested in not only their own success, but in the success of the others that are also on the team because of that empowerment model. And so that's really important when, especially when dealing with homelessness, with folks who have felt marginalized, have felt unincluded. And then, you know, one of the things, again, we didn't intend to do, but we saw the benefits of early on, those yellow shirts out there cleaning up changes perception. And that is incredibly important when trying anything else, even building affordable housing. One of the things we're particularly proud of is changing the folks that say not my backyard or the NIMBYs into the YIMBYs, yes, in my backyard. It doesn't happen with everybody, but having that community conversation, we're saying this person can be and would be a positive addition to your community if you invite them in. Incredibly important. Thanks, Susie, for presenting with me, and thanks, Don, for inviting us again. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Sure. So what we want to do now is to see which things you want to take away from the Downtown Streets example, so that we can get a read on what you think would be helpful things to engage about in your situation. And so click off as many as are relevant to you. And while we're doing that, we're bringing back our our presenters here so they can share with us their additional perspectives here, and we can address some more of the questions that have been flooding in here. And one of the questions I'd like to particularly ask you at the Downtown Streets is, you know, what did you find didn't work about the model of letting other people take your materials and go do it? And how have you been able to expand so actively to 15 other places when no one else has been able to seem to get a replicable model? What's the secret sauce here?
I'd say, you know, in terms of the original franchisees, if you will, the details are incredibly important in building a culture of community and support. With this model in particular is essential. And so we found that if you don't pay attention to the culture, if you don't truly entrust the team members to guide the program, that's where you can falter. I think a lot of more traditional homeless service approaches are very much service provider on one side of the glass and client on the other side of the glass. And I'm here to help you and I'm here to tell you what you need. And that actually works for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody. And a lot of folks are missing that sense of empowerment. And so with the four organizations that we're launching that, we noticed that kind of old hierarchy of service provider and client was still very much in place. The culture was not great. And folks, you know, not only did it not feel right, didn't feel as fun, didn't feel as encouraging, but they also weren't having the success that we were having. So there's that as well. And then in terms of the growth, ask my girlfriend, she does not like how much I travel and for work and everything. But I think the real answer is this is a need in a lot of communities is to change that perception. And to get the folks that are often blamed for a lot of these issues, whether it's encampment debris, behavioral issues, to be part of the solution, it's you know, it's an easy sell, if you will. And my job, usually when I come into a community, they're already saying, hey, we want you here, Downtown Streets team. So it's about facilitating that.
Okay. And we can certainly see from the responses to the survey that people were resonating very strongly with the idea of building coalitions, demonstrating success in small pilots, and addressing the community concerns, three pillars of your successes there. Want to encourage people, the most important thing you can do after today's webinar is to have some discussion amongst yourselves. What are your tough issues? What approaches would you like to consider from today's session? And what resources are going to help you to accelerate your progress, be they partners, be they grants, be they other things to help you be successful in these endeavors? We really want you to be thinking about how you can get these gnarly issues handled and addressed. There are lots of resources in the ICMA coaching program, the Career Compass columns written by Dr. Frank Benest. There are Coach Connect, one-to-one coaching. There's a series of talent development resources, all the archived webinars, a whole host of things. And we hope that you'll sign up for the newsletter here, which will give you instant and immediate information when new resources are available to you. So that's an important resource for you. We want to be covering some more of the questions that you have, but we also want to get to a polling question here at the end, which is to give some feedback to this webinar about to kick off as many things that are relevant to you that you got as value for yourself or for your agency. And we hope you will share it with others in your agency so that they can benefit from it. But what did you find of value that you think your community can use in going forward as it addresses these tough issues? While it's happening, I want to acknowledge that there are lots of questions that came in on the homelessness issues. In a moment, I'm going to be putting up the contact information for Chris Richardson and for Susie O'Hara. So if you've got the more detailed questions, and I see there's a lot of them about all different facets of the program, they would be your go-to people to get those answered. But while this is going on, I want to turn first to maybe John. And John, we're getting questions from people about municipalities being faced for the first time with addressing some of these challenges and how they can be a conduit for residents seeking services outside the normal scope of local government. As you teach this at UNC, as you have dealt with this along your long and successful career, what would you advise people about when they're getting drawn into something that's out of their typical wheelhouse? How might they navigate it? Just a few quick guidelines, if you would.
Yeah, I think the first thing is educating yourself and then educating the community on the core issues involved. You know, these two issues that came to us, we didn't have any experience with them. So, you know, we reached out to experts and then used those experts to communicate with the public what was going on. It's anytime there's a controversial issue, it's a good opportunity to get citizens involved. One of the things that I teach at UNC Chapel Hill is citizen engagement, and it's difficult to get citizens involved. But once there's a controversial issue, you normally can get some folks interested not only in that issue, so you should use that as an opportunity to develop relationships with them and educate them. And Don, if I may, I have already received emails from folks asking for the social media policy and the communications policy, and just let them know that I'll get those out to them. Probably be early next week. I'm getting ready to leave for a meeting that's out of town for a couple of days. So may not get those out until early next week, but I will get those out to everybody.
Okay, and if you would like to send any links to me, I can include that in the follow-up emails to everybody so that anybody who would like to access those could do it.
I'll be glad to do that.
Okay, great. That'll be super. So we're closing in on time here. What I wanted to do is to just turn, and we can see that people got benefit out of this webinar in many ways, so we appreciate that. In the closing moments here, I just want to turn to our presenters in turn, with John Crumpton first, and then Marie Peoples, and then Susie O'Hara and Chris Richardson. If you just offer a closing word or comment, to just something very brief that you'd like people to take away from today's session. You've each done a wonderful job in sharing your stories, and thank you so much for all the special work that you did with us in preparing today's webinar. John, if you would.
Well, I know we're almost out of time, so I'll be brief, but I would encourage the people on the webinar today to stay involved in these type of programs, and also if they have experiences, offer up to Don and ICMA to tell their stories, and because that's the best way to learn in this profession is from all of us communicating together. So I would encourage that interaction with everybody going forward.
Thanks, John, and thank you all for modeling that today. So Marie Peoples.
Yeah, I'll go back to my key word. Be prepared to pivot, embrace it, and I think you'll find that that's one of the primary ways you can get buy-in from your community and to gain trust.
Okay, super. Susie O'Hara from City of Santa Cruz.
Yes, I just wanted to express my appreciation to Don for putting this on and my co-presenters. In listening to our presentations, I think there's just so much that resonates across these different challenges, and appreciate the partnership with the Downtown Streets team, and available via email for any other follow-up questions.
Great. And Chris?
Well, I'd say in terms of advice, hire Susie. I see, 300 some odd people on the line. If you can't hire Susie, definitely find a way to collaborate and empower in order to build those communities that change perceptions and work together. And thank you all, my co-presenters, and for those who stuck around.
Great. Well, thank you all as presenters, and thank you, audience, for being with us today. Thank you for the courage that you have in your communities to embrace and engage the gnarly issues that are coming before you and to deal with them effectively and ethically and professionally, and encourage you to participate in our upcoming webinars that give you additional tools and approaches that are critical for dealing with gnarly issues. You have to have the trust of your organization, your community, your elected officials, and you have to have some very difficult conversations. And those two webinars will really give you lots of tools and practical examples to help you in accomplishing those roles. So this is Don Maruska on behalf of the ICMA coaching programs, thanking you all for being with us today. Hoping you enjoy your careers in local government. Let us know any way we can help you through the coaching program to enhance your success. Take care and have a great day.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.